The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Real Madrid. They beat Man City. They beat Man City with Rodrigo. But how did Real beat Man City? We don't know, but we're still going to talk about it anyway. Plus another game that left you and I bamboozled, Villarreal against Liverpool. We've got takes so hot they could warm pensioners for entire weeks. Plus trouble at Chelsea, cottages and cherries back in the Premier League, and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Carvajal. It's Carvajal's cross. Rodrigo! Oh, extraordinary! They prayed for miracles, and miracles arrived! Real Madrid, the team of dreams! Where has that come from? How did that happen?
Which game was that?
Peter Drury there. For everyone who, like Danny Jameson, was wondering how he, the master, would deal with two of the most extraordinary bits of Champions League action we've seen in many a year. Duncan Alexander is with us on this, the 5th of May, a Thursday. Also here, Adrian Clark. Hello, Adrian.
Hello.
And also Michael Cox. All right, Michael.
Hi, James.
Hi to you all. All right, headline this morning. In Marca, in Madrid, que baja Dios y lo explique. Let God come down and explain that. Adrian, Duncan and Michael, you'll have to stand in for kind of the universal force of balance, etc. But before we get into, you know, what happened, just one of the all-time greatest comebacks ever.
Up there with City against Gillingham in the playoff final.
It was spectacular, wasn't it? I just think over the two legs, they were so inferior, Real Madrid to Manchester City, that it is criminal of Pep Guardiola's side not to progress. I mean, you can laud the heart and the belief and the resilience of Real Madrid, and we should and we will, but that is, they've gifted that to the Spaniards, no doubt about it. But it made for an amazing cup tie. And we might not get those two-legged Champions League semi-finals moving forward, might we? So yeah, we've got to treasure them while they still exist.
All right. I mean, you're referring to this plan, and at the moment it is still very much a notion to do the semi-finals and final in a week in a venue. It might be that then the quarterfinals get to be every bit as exciting as these semi-finals have been. I don't know. But in the meantime, yes, Marca continuing the greatest night in the history of the Bernabeu. They will study this in the universities, says Marca. And they probably will. I'm sure they will. There's also a lovely little sidebar called Worst Decision of His Life with an interview with a fan. I don't know why I'm laughing. He sat outside on a curb outside the Bernabeu. He left 80 minutes into the game, and they wouldn't let him back in. He says, 24 years I've been a season ticket holder, but he should have known better. He should have known better, because they're always doing this, Real Madrid. Michael, how much did you enjoy Wednesday night?
Enjoyed it for many reasons, yeah. Particularly, I've got to say, it really annoys me when fans leave games early. So I'm delighted to hear that story. I did it once. My dad made me leave a Fulham Luton game, I think, early in about 1998, and we missed a consolation goal. It was 3-1, completely irrelevant. And that was in the days before everything was on TV, so I just never saw this goal. And because of that, I've never left a game early since. But yeah, the game was... I just didn't see the comeback coming. I mean, I really, even by the standards of the Champions League semi-finals, even by the standards of Real Madrid, it was extraordinary, because they'd created nothing really in the second half, aside from that very early chance when Carvajal crossed for Vinicius in the first 20 seconds of the second half. I thought City pretty much did everything well. I mean, I thought people are kind of pointing fingers at Guardiola and his substitutions, but I mean, the Gundogan change, that kind of created the goal. Grealish on down the left, I mean, he twice nearly made it 6-3. I mean, that's what the scoreline would have been had he scored 6-3. And even bringing on Fernandinho to defend the box made sense. They couldn't quite do it. Everything went Real Madrid's way. And Yeah, like you say, one of the most extraordinary comebacks I've seen.
89 minutes administered perfectly by Man City, followed by the sound of the entire Bernabeu press box tearing up their match reports. I should say, I feel the same way you do about fans leaving early with podcasts. You know, leave a podcast early. There's no telling what nuggets or gems of consolation you might miss out on, never to discover again. Something to think about. Anyway, all right. Well, you mentioned Guardiola and his substitutions. I'm sure we'll be talking about that. We should also salute Carlo Ancelotti, who becomes the first ever manager to reach five Champions League finals. Three of them will be against Liverpool. Pep's now the manager who's lost the most semi-finals. So Real didn't have a shot on target, I think, prior to Rodrigo's first goal in the 89th and a half minute. What happened?
Well, from where I was sitting, it looked like Manchester City were a team that got caught in the headlights. You know, it was they switched off for the equaliser, and from that moment on, the stadium believed that Real Madrid could come back, and so did the Real Madrid players. And I just sensed that City feared it too. I don't think they believed in themselves to shut down the game, and defenders started making poor decisions. There was a bad piece of marking from Laporte for Rodrigo. It was a brilliant header. It was a fantastic cross, a wonderful header. But I thought the marking from Laporte was sloppy for a player of his quality. And then obviously in extra time, Diaz makes a daft decision. You don't make those kind of decisions if your head isn't frazzled. And I just felt that City as a group, particularly the defensive players, were mentally all over the place at the climax of that game, and it's cost them, and has been a pattern, hasn't it? I mean, you look at a lot of their Champions League exits. There seems to be flurries of goals against them. It's something they need to work on.
I think we also have to remember that even for the best footballers on the planet, these are the biggest games you'll ever play. And you look at the, you know, Barcelona against Liverpool a few years ago, Bayern against United in 99. In matches that intense, once it starts going wrong, it can quickly just, you know, gather pace. And we saw that. I mean, I think if Kyle Walker had stayed fit for the whole game, it might have been better for City. Obviously, I think the refereeing was slightly, you know, I mean, Casemiro should have probably got at least three or four yellows. The ref blew up 3 minutes of added time in the second period of extra time, and he blew up on 2 minutes 50. The ball was in play for around about 14 or 15 minutes for the whole of extra time. I mean, it's funny, on the BT highlights, it ends, basically goes from the Foden header, Fernandinho chance at the back post at the end of the first half, straight to the full-time whistle, because that just explains what happened in the second period of extra time. Madrid did an incredible job of killing that game then, and City didn't really, you know, create much, and that would have been a disappointment. But it's the Champions League semi-finals. It's, as we're saying, it's as good as it gets, and this is just another one to add to the long list.
Games this big, goals can come in flurries, and Carlo's been on the receiving end of that, of course, in Istanbul. But this season, 2-0 down on aggregate to Paris Saint-Germain with 30 minutes remaining, they get through that one. 4-3 down to Chelsea with 10 minutes left of the second leg, and they get through that one. And then on three occasions, they were two goals down to City, and through they go.
Well, they trailed from the second minute of the first leg to the 90th minute of the second leg, and yet are still through. I mean, this is a slightly indulgent comparison, but the only campaign I can ever recall seeing like this was when Wickham got to the semi-finals of the FA Cup in 2001, where every game they should have gone out and they somehow pulled it round, and that run ended with a 2-1 defeat to Liverpool. So, you know,
that's the one they mentioned in Marker as well on Thursday morning. So
yeah, that's in the old High Wycombe studies of Madrid University side panel, I think. Yeah.
Adrian, you said it was criminal for Man City not to qualify for the final, but we should hail the genius, the obscure genius for many people, of Carlo Ancelotti, and how he's managed to pull this off and reach a fifth final. Michael, he's not hailed as one of his generation's great tacticians. Is part of what genius he has, the fact that it's never about him. Even last night, he wasn't the story. Should he be?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're spot on with that. He's always been a manager who, well, not actually not always been a manager, since he kind of did his big change in the late 90s when he was kind of inspired by Zidane, he's always since then been a manager who bases his sides around the players. And I think the thing that struck me last night was how calm he was. Everything that happened, he remained almost unflappable on the sidelines. And I think that when you look at his decision making, even though there was a bit of luck and a bit of, you know, the game was out of control by the end, he did make the right decisions. He didn't gamble too early. He took until 67 minutes before he opened up the game. I think if that was a basketball game for 45 minutes or 90 minutes, Manchester City would have won. But he waited until the right moments really before he essentially put on all his attacking players. He completely sacrificed his usual midfield three and went with Camavinga and Valverde, who were the most mobile two. And I mean, I just think both managers actually got the changes right. I think they basically feel they did everything they could. And at the end of the day, the game is shaped by the managers and it's decided by the players. And it came down to, you know, few individual contributions here.
Ancelotti's got a knack, hasn't he, of sort of empowering world-class players. He's worked with so many unbelievable talents, and they seem to, yeah, without having to sort of overload them with tactical ideas, you know, complicated frameworks, he does get the best out of them. I do agree with Michael. I think he played it right, and that calmness definitely emanates to the players on the pitch. It's such a contrast, isn't it? You feel as if Real Madrid are quite relaxed, not overloaded with information, whereas Pep wants to micromanage every situation. And Manchester City are a better team than Real Madrid, but when in the heat of the moment, when everything around you is going a little bit crazy, maybe that calmer style is more suitable. I don't know.
Michael, you were saying that you felt Pep made the right substitutions. He probably would have spent the night going over what he could have done, what he should have done. What do you think he might have come up with?
I don't know, really. I think the only substitution that didn't work out for Manchester City was the one that was enforced. Because when Walker went off, Cancelo had to switch sides. Zinchenko came on. And I always feel Zinchenko's not really the best defender. And Real got a lot of joy down that flank, pushing Carvajal forward. So like I say, I'm not really sure they could have done much different. I think the substitutions made sense. And it was just one of those things.
Do you think the substitution of De Bruyne made sense? Because for me, De Bruyne has been absolutely brilliant of late. He's been stellar. I think Bernardo Silva was probably the pick of the bunch in this game. But De Bruyne has just been so good in so many big matches of late. I just think unless he's injured, you keep him on.
I didn't think he played that well last night.
No, he wasn't his greatest night, but it's De Bruyne. And I think that he has been in terrific form. I thought that was a mistake.
He goes under the radar slightly as a bit of a... Like, if all players to score 50 or more Premier League goals, he's got the highest proportion of goals scored at home. And I think he is brilliant at the Etihad, but I can see why he was substituted last night. I think in away games, he sometimes... He just seemed slightly... There was a couple of misplaced passes in the second half, a couple of sort of decisions that, you know, you can imagine him making much better ones in a different game. So I didn't think that was a radical move.
Yeah, I mean, Guardiola can't really have expected the game to have changed quite so dramatically. I mean, they went from kind of preserving a lead to desperately trying to get back in the tie. And I do wonder, I mean, last night was an interesting example of games these days that are influenced by the fact there's so many substitutions. And I'm kind of against five substitutes for various reasons. But one of them is, I tend to think it allows the manager too much control. I quite like the fact that they were only allowed to tinker kind of three times with it. When it's five and six, it feels like they've got too much control. But I suppose there's another argument you can make, and that actually once so many players come onto the pitch fresh like that, actually the managers don't have any control. It's kind of like a playground game. It's kind of back and forth. And I do wonder, I mean, in relation to the De Bruyne thing, now that there's so much freedom with the substitutions managers are allowed, I wonder whether the next thing will be that actually you're allowed to bring players back on after they've been substituted off, because I think City would have done that with De Bruyne, wouldn't they? There was a point where they didn't need him. But as soon as it went into extra time and you were thinking who's really going to grab the game by the scruff of the neck, I think De Bruyne would have taken his tracksuit top off and been wheeled back out.
A bit like Kyle Walker did actually during the game, no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
My last ever appearance in the red and white of Arsenal was in a charity game at Barnet, and it was a rolling subs type affair. And I played in the first half, came off, and then in midway through the second half, they said, "Clarkey, get yourself back on." And it was a throw-in, and they said, "Go on, just go on." And from the throw-in, the guy hooked the ball up the line for me to chase. In said chase, I pulled my hamstring and never played again. So maybe it's not the best. But I probably was around 40 at the time. Mm. So Kevin might have got away with it a little bit more than me. But that is the danger. They definitely would have liked to.
I wonder if he thought that last night, sat on the bench, like, would like to get back out there, but I don't want to do an Adrian Clarke at Underhill.
It was so embarrassing. Yeah, it was right in front of. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah, quite a humbling experience. But no, I get it. I get it. And I'm with Michael totally about the three sub thing. I think he made that point really well. And yeah, I'm fully behind that. It helped Real Madrid, didn't it? Because what they did, they were able to effectively change their entire midfield and other bits. And that midfield was very youthful towards the end of the game, and you could see the mobility that they were able to travel up the pitch with the ball at their feet like they weren't earlier on in the game as City tired. Camavinga was brilliant at it, wasn't he? So yeah, it gave Ancelotti license to really regenerate his team on the night, and it worked for them. But for me, three is better.
Mm. We've touched on some of the key incidents. After Mahrez's goal, which looked like it had settled things, then that incredible moment when Jack Grealish could have put them two up on the night. I'm still not sure how Mendy clears that makes that goal line clearance. And then you get, well, it goes to extra time, and then you have the penalty. I was convinced that Benzema, who had a dismal record from the spot prior to that Panenka last week, would miss this time round. Spanish comms didn't sound too calm either.
Está el personal flipando, va a caer. Mételo, caer. Gol, 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 gol. A la derecha y para dentro.
Sí, señor.
Marca Karim Benzema.
How would you feel if you were a Liverpool supporter Thursday morning? On one hand, the chance, as Mo Salah mentioned, for revenge for 2018. On the other, though, this team have a charmed life.
I'd be delighted if I was a Liverpool fan, to be honest. I know that they've just beaten Manchester City, but I think Real Madrid are far inferior to them. And there's always going to be a danger of them pulling out. But I mean, I haven't expected Real Madrid to get through any of the three rounds up to this point. I think I've seen them win six European Cups, and in none of those finals did I think they would win. So, I mean, there's no point really making predictions, but I don't think Real Madrid will win this either.
Mm. Which sounds like a prediction in itself. Colin Miller pointing out that since 2001, Spanish teams have played non-Spanish teams 16 times in European finals, and they've won all of them, all 16. Whew.
It's quite surprising to see Mo Salah being so kind of bullish about this. It's not really fits into his his, you know, usual persona. So,
but that moment with Ramos is clearly burned on, as you'd expect it to, for through all these years of success.
Yeah, I mean, that game remains one of the most bizarre Champions League finals. I actually watched that game in Italy on holiday, and I don't know why, but the coverage had no commentator, so it was just crowd noise, which was kind of good, but also was quite confusing as well. So when, like, all the Loris Carrier stuff, I didn't know what was going on, because, you know, I hadn't heard that. I mean, I know he'd got injured, but I didn't, you know, the commentators would have obviously been saying about concussion, etc. So yeah, it was a very strange final, that. But
clean audio is an option for most digital sports networks in civilized countries. Yeah.
Ramos will probably be there, right? He must live down the road from the final now.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary game. We could have been sat here talking about a completely different scoreline, but there it is. Real Madrid are through to face Liverpool in the Champions League final, and Pep Guardiola has lost another semi-final. Crikey. Before we move on to what Liverpool got up to on Tuesday, which was quite entertaining as well, do you think this is going to impact at all on Manchester City's Premier League campaign? They've got Newcastle coming up at the weekend. Players tired, I imagine. Kyle Walker's not going to feature, I'd also imagine.
Yeah, I think that's a blow, isn't it? It was a gamble. He admitted it ahead of kickoff that he was rolling the dice on Kyle Walker. And yeah, you think about the weekend, Kyle Walker up against Sam Maximan. It's a matchup that he would have been confident in. But now they need to swap things around. I think there could be collateral damage, obviously mentally, from the blow. It should focus their minds, really, shouldn't it? It should make them even more determined to not blow the season entirely. I think they'll be okay. I don't think it would derail them, but there is that danger. And you know, other teams will maybe smell blood a little bit more and just say, look, if you can put the ball into their box, if you can actually get some kind of territory against Manchester City and test this defence, cracks do appear.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there was a formula there for say Newcastle to follow, but I guess we'll find out. They're playing Sunday 4:30, by which time they may well be. They have a great record, by the way, against Newcastle at home. They won the last 12 fixtures in this series. They may well be 2 points behind because Liverpool have got Spurs Saturday evening, and equally, Liverpool have a pretty good record against them. We'll talk about Liverpool next.
Manchester City hearts were broken in the Bernabeu late on Wednesday night as Real Madrid performed a Houdini escape to bring the game to extra time and then managed to perform the knockout blow to City via the penalty spot and Karim Benzema. City and Pep will need a few days to regroup, that's for sure, and the focus will now go on Liverpool in the title race who face Antonio Conte's fourth place chasing Spurs at Anfield on Saturday night. In terms of the title race, betting will Man City are 4-9 the favourites and Liverpool are 7-4. 1 point separates them with 4 games to go each. Get the popcorn out. Liverpool are winning games for fun at the moment and could be about to do something really special in terms of a treble or a quadruple season under Klopp. They are the favourites against Spurs at a price of 2-5. The draw is 15-4 and the away win is 11-2. Remember, next up for Spurs after this is Arsenal on Thursday in a North London derby. That could be a battle to the death in terms of that last highly coveted Champions League spot. So it's a massive couple of days for Tottenham and Conte. Spurs are 17-10 for a top four finish, while the Gunners are 2-5. Then on Sunday, Man City will play host to Newcastle and will be hoping to feel no ill effects from their midweek Champions League trauma in Madrid. They'll be looking to be all businesslike and are 1-7 to win the game. The draw is 13-2 and the Magpies' win is 14-1. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
All right, 24 hours before the Bernabeu bedlam, there was a mad match too at the Ceramica. To recap, Liverpool came into the tie with Villarreal 2-0 up against a side that hadn't managed a single shot on target in the first leg and had been described as a disgrace to the competition. They promptly went 2-0 down, did Liverpool. But then recovered to win in the second half, 3-2 on the night, 5-2 on aggregate. Did you see the tweet from Arsenal fan Partey Time, who at half-time with Liverpool 2-0 down wrote, "If I remember anything about Emery, it's that he'll shut up shop now and Liverpool will score 3. Boom. Is that what happened here?
I thought that did happen a little bit, actually. Yeah, it did feel like a few of the Arsenal games under Emery where when Arsenal are in a kind of position where they can just play their natural game, they actually don't really have a natural game. But in fairness, Liverpool improved. The introduction of Diaz certainly made a big difference. I thought Fabinho was excellent in the first 20 minutes of the second half. Just got such intelligence, such control on the ball. And I think, to be fair to Liverpool, I think they were excellent in terms of almost just putting the first half behind them and not playing like they were shell-shocked and essentially just going back to their natural game, which has been positive on the ball. There's so many forward runs in the second half from Alexander-Arnold, from Robertson, even from Fabinho, who I think two or three times made that run that eventually brought the goal for him. And I think that's quite brave to do when you've been kind of caught out on the break, you've been exposed at the back, to just actually have the bravery to make lots of forward runs. I know it sounds like a simple thing, but I think that was really the main thing that got them back in the tie.
Yeah, the ability in football to park a bad 45 minutes or to park a bad 20 minutes is absolutely critical. And all of the best teams can just stay calm, regroup, work out what they need to do and change it for the better. And that's what they did. Dealing with disappointment is huge in football. Manchester City dealt with the disappointment of conceding that equaliser terribly. They dealt with the disappointment of going to extra time awfully. Liverpool were the opposite, and they were able to park it. And I think a lot of it comes down to, some of it at least, comes down to Klopp being calm at half-time. By all accounts, he was really cool, didn't raise his voice, just the message was, we will win this game, settle down, play your normal game. And Villarreal will run out of puff, basically. And that's kind of what they did. Fitness got to them.
Speaking of running out, what about Geronimo Rullio, eh? I mean, Emery deserves credit for a fantastic first half, but his goalkeeping choice, it's not as if this was completely out of character from the Villarreal goalkeeper.
No, for all Liverpool's calm and control, I think they were very much helped by the first keeper to make two errors leading to a goal in a Champions League game since Loris Karius in the 2018 final. Mm.
Would you need commentary on these ones?
I think I'd have worked that out with the old eyes, yeah. Just on Adrian's point about Klopp being calm at half-time, there's no point smashing teacups in the home of ceramics because they're just very easily replaced. So he definitely did the right thing there.
It's the first time that Liverpool, points out Ollie Hopkins, have been two goals down and not lost in the Champions League since, do you know when?
Istanbul?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, they're through to their third Champions League final in the last 5 years. Do you feel a bit bad for Unai Emery, starting really aside?
No, I mean, I think he's emerged from this season with a lot of credit for various reasons. I mean, it's worth remembering that there was one point where he looked nailed on to get the Newcastle job and people thought he was going to go. So to stay on with Villarreal and take them to Champions League semi-final, having won the Europa League last year. No, I mean, he's... The one thing I kind of don't really understand is people saying, oh, should he have been given more time at Arsenal? I mean, it's a bit like David Moyes at Manchester United. He didn't do a good job. He was sacked because he wasn't doing a good job. Fair play to him for bouncing back. He's more than recovered his reputation. So, no, I don't really feel sorry for him.
Okay. Remarkable stat, by the way, from Villarreal's time in this year's tournament. From the equaliser from Dani Parejo against Juve in the last 16, they scored with 8 shots on target in a row, including the 2 that they had against Liverpool. Incredible. That's remarkable efficiency. All right. You suggested that maybe teams had seen a way to put pressure on Man City, Adrian. And I said, I'm not sure if there was any kind of recipe there, but what Villarreal did to Liverpool in the first half, is that something that, say, Spurs might look at for this weekend?
I think it was as much about Liverpool being a little bit too relaxed as well ahead of kickoff. I don't think they readied themselves for the storm that Villarreal threw at them. And sometimes you can get caught up in that and it takes a while to recover. And you just got to hope the damage isn't too much. I don't think so. I think Spurs will go there with their own plan. I think that Spurs at Liverpool is stylistically a game that's okay for Tottenham and for Conte, because Liverpool need the win, clearly. They'll play their usual way. Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold will fly forward. And where are the spaces going to be? They're going to be in behind them, down the sides of the centre-halves for Son Heung-min or Kulusevski to race away. And I think they'll get chances. I do, in the game. I wonder what it will do, because Matip has been so good this season alongside Van Dijk, but Konate is a little bit quicker. And I just wonder whether that will come into his thinking. Obviously, Kanate's a lucky player for Liverpool as well in regards to the winning record. But Son up against Liverpool, I think, is a really interesting battleground. A lot of gooners out there are almost banking on this being a Spurs blank, but I don't see it that way. I think that they can score at Anfield and make it competitive.
Do you think this could be where the title race gets decided if it hasn't already been? Point between them. See Liverpool dropping points here?
I can see it being a score draw. I think if history tells you that Spurs will, you know, don't really ever win at Anfield, but they did win at City. They did the double over Manchester City, and they're the sort of team that needs opponents to come at them. We know that, and Liverpool will do that. No question. And Spurs, if they're efficient and if they're clinical, and they have been among the most clinical teams in the Premier League this season, then they've got a chance. I'm a little bit nervous from an Arsenal point of view about the game.
Mm. Spurs, of course, 2 points behind Arsenal in the race for fourth place.
I mean, this feels like a sort of director's supercut of 2017-18, because we've got a Champions League final of Liverpool against Real Madrid, and then 2018-19 where... you know, City and Liverpool with this flawless title race. I mean, yeah, it seems likely they'll probably both win again this weekend. But yeah, I mean, the reverse fixture at Spurs was 2-2, wasn't it? And that was one of the best games of the season. Obviously, Andy Robertson with a goal and assist and a red card, which is a good little combo. But yeah, I mean, I think Spurs do have the potential to upset Liverpool both stylistically and temperamentally. Is that a word? Probably not. In this game. So yeah, it's at the strange Saturday night time. So who knows how players will react to such a time slot.
Although they did all right with the night time slot on Tuesday, eventually. All right, very good. That was what happened in the Champions League midweek. We haven't had the Thursday night games yet. So next up, let's move on to the rest of the Premier League weekend.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporter Support Line. We're talking to Liverpool fan Dave about their upcoming game with Spurs.
Yeah, like Liverpool, I think Spurs can do their own quadruple.
A Spurs quadruple?
Yeah, the fourth consecutive year out of the Champions League. It hasn't been rewarding lately for Spurs, but if you want rewards, then try a completely free £5 bet builder on Liverpool v Spurs this weekend. Paddy Power.
Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min 2 plus legs. Max 1 free £5 bet per customer. Must have previously deposited to avail. 7-day free bet expiry. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, smart speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Billing, left-footed, it's a cheeky one, square, and Spurs in! Kiefer Moore! 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 Moore!
Welcome back, Bournemouth. Good table, 1-0, Kiefer Moore with a late goal against Nottingham Forest. And we were talking about a considerable amount on Monday. The Cherries are now back in the Premier League after a couple of seasons away. Forest go into the playoffs. Duncan Alexander tweeting, a tricky night for former European champions against sides who have employed Danjuma. Anyway, disappointment for Matt Davis-Adams and Nick Miller. You can get Matt's reaction. I'm sure it'll be fair and equanimous. In the Totally Football League show, that's out. Now, I think, is it? They'll also be talking about later on today, says Adrian. Are you in that one, Adrian?
Yeah. Recording it straight after this. So, yeah.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, give us the good stuff now. Come on.
League One playoffs. You'll be previewing those. They get underway Thursday night with Wickham Wanderers taking on MK Dons. Mm. Duncan?
Yes. It's sold out, which is exciting. and yes, yeah,
God, that is a small club if you're getting excited about that.
All right, well, the King's saying last year. Yeah, no, it's going to be... Wickham have got a very bad record against the team from Milton Keynes. So, yeah, it's quite daunting. But, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Okay, that's the first leg. On Friday, then, you've got, I believe, also a sellout, excitingly, for Sunderland. They've got 45,000 who are turning up for their clash with Sheffield Wednesday.
The reason I mentioned the sellout, which amused Michael so much, is because Sunderland have sold out. I'm pretty sure Sheffield Wednesday will sell out. Wickham have sold out. But Wickham have only been given 2,000 tickets for the second leg on Sunday. And Milton Keynes, even though their stadium will probably have about, I don't know, 10,000 empty seats, they claim it's because they're preparing the ground for a My Chemical Romance concert in a few weeks. But for me, I would simply sell more tickets and use up the space. But there we go.
Have you got yourself a ticket for the sold-out clash this evening, Duncan?
I will be going to that one, yes, and I will be checking that every seat is filled and on a big spreadsheet. So, yeah.
All right. Don't leave
early. You want some of the good stuff, Duncan, right? This is the ultimate clash in styles. I think we know that. MK
is
Don's.
It,
well, I think it is. I think it is. Right. I don't know if you'll know this stat, but I've just seen it. 10 plus pass sequences, okay? So 10 or more passes in a row. MK Don's lead the way in League One with 531 sequences. Wickham Wanderers, 24. Over the course of the season. So that is quite the difference in
style. Half of those have come in the last 12 games. So there has been a slight stylistic shift. So, but yeah, you're right. It is two different approaches to life and football coming together.
What's Gareth Ainsworth's approach? What's his philosophy?
Just rock music mainly. He was singing at a concert near Wickham at the weekend, so I'm sure that will have relaxed him ahead of a big match. Yeah, he sings in a band.
He sings in a band, yeah. Do we have any of his music, producer Charlie?
I've just checked, and My Chemical Romance at Milton Keynes is actually not sold out. Which isn't a surprise because the tickets are £74, which is quite expensive in my view.
It's very expensive. All right then. Oh, quick shout for next Tuesday at the Glee Club when we'll be going live. That's next week now with Duncan and Michael. And it says here, Julian Laurence, although Duncan, I know you've got one or two things to say about his inclusion.
Well, he tried to put me off in the third place playoff, didn't work. So I think we'll iron it out pre-gig, and then it should be fine for the watching public. Yeah, I think it'll be okay. But
maybe we'll just keep that simmering tension stoked. Maybe we'll throw in an extra round. I have live mind games. I don't know. Anyway, glee.co.uk is where you can see Julianne and Duncan and Michael and me and producer Charlie on Tuesday evening. I think it's 7:30. Grand. Hey, Premier League, round 36 for some, 35. I mean, teams have played different amounts. But anyway, here's what they've got this weekend. Liverpool, as we mentioned, they have the Saturday night game at home to Spurs. Man City play a day later, Sunday 4:30 against Newcastle. Chelsea, who are in third and in the midst of yet more ownership turmoil, more on that shortly, host Wolves on Saturday afternoon. Arsenal, in fourth place, three behind Chelsea and two above Spurs, face Leeds Sunday lunchtime. Man United are at Brighton Saturday tea time. And down the bottom, Everton visit Leicester on Sunday. Burnley host Villa and Watford are at Palace Saturday at 3. A match that could see Roy relegated against his former club. Also this weekend, Brentford Saints, Norwich West Ham. What's the most significant game in that lot, do you think? Is it Everton's visit to the King Power, possibly? Everton fresh from beating Chelsea, 2 points from safety with a game in hand, but with the worst record on the road in Christendom.
Yeah, probably. I think the fact that Arsenal, Leeds and Leicester, Everton are happening at the same time is key, I think, because obviously, you know, if Arsenal beat Leeds as expected and Everton can get something at Leicester, then Leeds are very much the team spiralling down to the Championship, which I don't know. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but it does feel like they are the team at the moment that seem kind of destined to go down.
Oof, big shout. Michael, you were watching Leeds last weekend in their defeat to Man City. Did they look like a team destined for the drop?
No, not really. I mean, I thought, obviously they lost 4-0, but I thought for long periods they battled quite well, caused City a few problems. It was their first defeat in six. The atmosphere was brilliant at Elland Road. Jesse Marsh was very positive afterwards about the performance. I'm not sure. I really don't know who will go down. I mean, I think an interesting game is Burnley against Aston Villa, because I'm not sure the sides on 40 points are definitely safe. It could be a really crazy season.
You've also got Brentford, Southampton as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few interesting games this weekend.
Yeah, Brentford, for example, they are, like Southampton, 8 points above the drop zone. But Burnley, Leeds and Everton all have games in hand on Brentford. And Brentford's final two games are against Everton and Leeds. Yikes. So, I mean, they should be all right, but football's a fickle beast.
Yeah. Well, we haven't seen a team go down with 40 or more points since West Ham in the 2000s. So, obviously people used to say, well, you've got to get to 40 points. Well, generally it's sort of 35, 36 should keep you up. But, yeah, if Leeds, Everton, Burnley keep winning, then Brentford, Southampton, Villa, maybe even Palace on 41. Are still in danger. So I mean that would be a twist, wouldn't it? Patrick Vieira's excellent first season ending in a surprise relegation.
Oh, they've got a positive goal difference at the moment. So I mean, if they go down with something like those kind of points, yeah.
That's the issue with Leeds, isn't it? They're on minus 34, which is a lot worse than Burnley on minus 15. So
sorry, Leeds' goal difference is minus 34.
Yeah, Leeds have let in more goals than any other club this season. So
that's a lot. Crikey. Okay, you mentioned, can Everton keep winning? I mean, the issue is their form on the road. What is it, seven straight away defeats under Frank Lampard? Worst records, I think, anywhere in football apart from Grittefurt at the bottom end of the Bundesliga. And Leicester, though, might be a good time to play them. They're in Rome Thursday evening. They haven't won any of their last four league meetings with Everton, the most recent of which came a long time ago, a whole fortnight back, when they were seconds away from victory, actually, at Goodison Park, and then Richarlison got a stoppage time equaliser.
Yeah. If you think back about that game, though, Richarlison should have scored about four. He missed a number of sort of open goals in the game, and Leicester really struggled to handle him. He's in good form. I think he's the one shining light, along with obviously Anthony Gordon, that they can look to in the final weeks to try and make something happen. He's in the goals. He's got a really good record against Leicester, actually. I think he scored five in seven appearances against them. And I was looking at the recent run of form. Basically, he's responsible for half of their XG, Richarlison. He's the one getting on the end of all the good chances. So yeah, I don't want to put too much pressure on the lad ahead of the weekend, but you know, their survival prospects, you know, may depend quite heavily on his ability to convert chances at the King Power and in the remaining games. So yeah, this is they have to get something, I think, from this game at Leicester, because Leicester are fallible. You know, they're a flawed side, defensively not great, often concede goals. This is an opportunity, I think, given the circumstance with the Thursday night game, for them to get a point, at least.
They are 2 points below Burnley, whose turf moor is now officially a tough place to go again. Duncan, you spent a lot of time rowing back on the public's perception of it being a tricky away fixture, only for it then to become a tricky away fixture again. They've won three straight matches there now.
Well, and also, if there is one club in football where Turf Moor is a tough place to go, it's Aston Villa. They've won just one of their last 26 away games against Burnley. Wow. So, Villa fans, fine. Turf Moor is a tough place to go.
Okay. This is the first meeting between these sides this season. It's May. They will have the return in, I think, is it next week? Is it in a week's time? Very soon, anyway, because the season's about to wrap up. Adrian, sorry.
Yeah, I did a bit of analysis for the Premier League on Burnley under Mike Jackson. this week. They haven't lost at home to anyone 12th or below, so that gives them hope, I think, in this particular match. But the main thread of my piece was looking at what's changed. I think we can all see they're a bit more attack-minded, playing with more freedom. But some of the numbers are really interesting. Like ball carries, for instance, okay? It looks with my eyes as if they're saying, well, give the ball to the wingers and let them do something, you know, let them run at defenders or central midfielders. Instead of hoiking the ball over the top for a striker to chase, take a bit of responsibility. Run with it if you have to. They were averaging 65 ball carries a game under Dyche. That's now 90 ball carries a game under Mike Jackson. Quite striking. Expected goals has gone up from 1.1 to 2 per game. Shots up from 10.2 to 14. They're having more of the ball. Lots more touches inside the opposition box. So, yeah, they're a different proposition right now compared to what they were earlier on in the season. I think it's just because Jackson has liberated the players. He said, look, we've still got this framework. We've still got the sort of basis of what you're used to, but I just want you to take a bit more responsibility and enjoy your football. And it's worked until this point.
More of a thriller under Michael Jackson, etc.
They're not bad anymore, Duncan.
Yeah.
They're facing a Villa side. Can they beat it?
When Dyche got sacked, pretty much unanimously, everyone said it was a terrible decision. And
right.
It hasn't proved that way. I'm trying to think of
yeah.
The...
No, you know,
when,
for
I remember
sure.
When Nigel Adkins left Southampton, everyone had a similar reaction, and when Pochettino came in, and then sometimes it just works.
Yeah, that bit of the decision worked, but people, to be fair to them, although there was a certain kind of nostalgia for the rasping tones of Sean Dyche, the other kind of issue was the way that the whole takeover had happened and the fact that it had lumped the club with this massive debt of, what, 100 million, that essentially a leveraged takeover. They bought the club by borrowing against the club. And this week, as it happens, we hear that part of the terms of the loan deal is that if they do go down, they will be liable for early repayment on... Figures seem to vary. I've seen 65 million mentioned as what needs early repayment as opposed to in 2025, which, to be fair, not that far away. But it just underlines why... Crikey, getting 3 points in this game could be huge.
But all that is a fairly separate thing from the decision to change the manager, surely.
Oh, yeah. That's
it's not like Dyche was saying you can't pass laterally or carry the ball because there's a £65 million
no,
debt.
No, you're absolutely
maybe
right.
Maybe he did. Maybe that's why they had to get rid. They were like, this is avant-garde at best.
No, you're right. But there were, I'm sure, people who said, who are these people? They've laden the club with debt and they've... So, no, you're right. That part of the decision-making may well prove to have been huge for Burnley. The other part absolutely, well, I mean, looks disastrous.
It is mad that it's still allowed to buy a football club by basically borrowing against that football club. I mean, you know, Manchester United being the most famous example, but how is that even allowed, really?
Beats me, Duncan.
Well, if they do go down, James, then they're in massive trouble, aren't they? Because they'd have to strip back the asset, the best playing assets, they will, you know, the wage bill will come down, and that power that Premier League clubs have with the parachute payments and whatnot will be sort of watered down quite heavily, wouldn't it? So it's a really significant few weeks in the club's history. You'd think that
this weekend could meanwhile seal the relegation of Watford, who are at Crystal Palace, who, as Duncan points out, aren't safe entirely yet, and Hodgson has confirmed he won't be at Watford next season, whatever. He expects this to be his last job. Only Liverpool and Man City have conceded fewer home goals than Palace this season. There you go. Now, we'll touch on one or two other things, including this dramatic news about the Chelsea takeover next.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only, get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
5th of May, on this day in 1956, was the, I would suggest, the most famous football injury ever, when Bert Trautmann played on for Man City with a broken neck.
But what's happened? Trautmann's down. He's injured. Teammates help Trautmann to his feet. He tells the trainer he's all right, but the crowd can see his neck is hurting badly.
It was the FA Cup final between City and Birmingham City. He was injured when making a save and played on with a broken neck. And if you go to the Football Museum in Vienna, a lovely spot, you can see the neck brace he wore while pulling off this remarkable example of old-school, proper football man-ness. He does say, I didn't know I'd broken my neck. I would have left the game immediately had I done so, but... yeah.
Don't ruin it. Don't
but
ruin
I remember it. I remember being a kid, and my dad used to mention Bert Trautmann a lot, and it was right. Always in this sort of, you know, why... be brave like Bert Trautmann, but yeah, he wasn't brave. He was just medically
Well, he was brave. I mean, I imagine it hurt. He was a former prisoner of war, wasn't he, Bert Trautmann? He'd been interned and then elected to stay on.
That film that came out about him a few years ago is very good. I really enjoyed
that.
I don't know if you saw it.
Well, yeah. Oh, okay. Do you know what it was called, Michael?
I can't remember, but I'm sure Google will work it out for you. But he also had a very interesting managerial career. He managed Liberia and Pakistan and Burma, I think. Fascinating guy. Everyone remembers the breaking the neck thing, but I think what happened before and after that is, equally fascinating. One of the most interesting figures in the history of English football, I'd say.
Wow. The Keeper is a British-German biographical film directed by Marcus H. Rosenmüller and starring German actor David Cross, uniquely, as the footballer, it says here. I'm guessing the footballer. Yeah, the footballer Bert Trautmann. There you go. Right. Check that out. Excellent. Also on this day, the lowest ever league crowd for Arsenal. Adrian, do you know how much this was?
Adrian's debut, wasn't it?
There were a few empty seats on my debut. I remember that. I've got a picture showing it, but I think that was because it was taken in injury time when most people had left. But the was it 4,000 or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, 4,500. This is 5th of May 1966. Not a big year for football in this country. And Arsenal were taking on Leeds. Same fixture. How about that? As this weekend. At Highbury, and just 4,454 people made the effort to turn up for that. All right.
I remember a few games where there were zero people in attendance, to be fair, which is less than 4,000.
Yeah, certainly.
You like non-league football, though, right?
Now, Arsenal, as we mentioned, are 3 points behind Chelsea, so third place potentially within their reach. Chelsea as well, at the moment, have other things to worry about. The sale of the club, which had seemed ready to be signed off on, has hit an 11th hour, or perhaps I should say 89.5-minute hitch, with the word that Roman Abramovich has changed his mind about a pretty key promise to write off $1.6 billion in debt that the club has with him. How serious a threat is this to Chelsea? Amid reports that it could even cost them their place in the league. What? Let's find out with Matt Slater. Matt, thank you so much for taking time out from literally writing about the Chelsea takeover. But first of all, how serious a hitch is this word about the Abramovich loan?
Well, I mean, it is serious, but I'm a little bit confused by some of the reporting on this over the last week or so, because this hitch has been known about for some time. I mean, the whole thing is serious. You know, turn the clock back 2.5 months. This is serious, Chelsea fans. Wake up. And it's incredibly complicated and unprecedented. All those cliches that we keep hearing and reading about are true. Football has never had a takeover like this before. It's never had a club effectively become a frozen asset of a sanctioned individual at a time when there's a war raging and that individual's country is becoming an exile from, well, you know, kind of Western politics, but football. This hasn't happened before. And this club is not just any club. It's the world and European champions, you know, massive club, but equally a club that has attained this status because of the lavish generosity of this individual, Roman Abramovich, and owes him a lot of money. So this is so weird, so odd, so unusual. The timeline has to be accelerated. We all know, we've all talked about it, you know, the license they're operating under, you know, the natural deadlines of football, season ending, transfer window opening, contracts coming up. It's all weird. So yes, this is a hitch, but it's been a hitch from the beginning. And the people that have been part of the process, the people who have been making the bids, have been aware of this from the outset. When it was all reported last week, none of them pulled out. We have a preferred bidder now in Todd Boehly's group. It hasn't pulled out. The clock is ticking. Todd Boehly has time to do this deal. And I would argue he still can and still should. But yes, none of this is easy. And he has got to move pretty quick.
Okay. Although that does sound comforting compared to the alarming reports in the last couple of days that this might effectively scupper the Boehly move or one of the other bids, and even see Chelsea without an owner and thus out of the league come the new season, was one particularly alarmist headline that I saw. What you're saying is you would expect, despite all these headlines, things to proceed at a fairly accelerated rate, and whilst it's all very unprecedented, there is at least one extremely rich person ready to stand in for the previous very rich person, yeah, as the kind of safeguarder of this club.
Yes, I would, but with the massive caveat that this could all go wrong because of all those things I said in my first bit.
You know? Right.
This could all fall over tomorrow. It could. So I guess those headlines are onto something. But, like I said, we had four very, very, you know, in terms of sports entrepreneurs and sort of, you know, US finance with you know, with UK representation in there as well. We had four star-studded bidders that went to three. They're still there. None of them have flounced off. Yeah, there's some sour grapes and there's been some briefing going on, but none of them have flounced off, and they'd all love the opportunity to get this deal done. And one has preferred bidder status and is, you know, quietly, diligently, as fast as it can, getting its ducks in a row. But as you say, a fourth person has come back, you know, in the shape of Sir Jim Ratcliffe, one of Britain's richest men. You know, I'm writing a piece about him at the moment. What a complicated guy he is, but what a fascinating and interesting guy he is. He's desperate to buy this club. He gave a 25-minute interview to the BBC last night. You know, he's on the record. I want to buy this club. So, yes, there are problems. Yes, there are obstacles. Yes, this is incredibly complicated. And if it goes wrong, bad things are going to happen to Chelsea.
Matt, can I ask? It's all well and good spending this gargantuan amount of money buying the club, but what's going to be left over for running it and investing in the team moving forward? Because this Chelsea squad kind of needs a little bit of a rebuild. Is Todd Boehly well equipped to spend as lavishly as Roman Abramovich has been spending down the years, or not? Given that he might have to pay more than he anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it's something that they all have to be mindful of. And it's something that Abramovich and these people need to be mindful of as well. You know, do not try and gouge these people too much, because they're different to him. they have different motivations to him. They are buying the club for different reasons. The American private equity-led wave of investment that's coming into British football and will continue just is coming at this because they like football. They've been watching from afar and they're thinking this is truly the global game and there's upside here. And yes, football clubs are now an asset class. This is the language they use. But, you know, don't be too turned off by that. We might not like the language, but winning is important. Todd Bowley runs the LA Dodgers. Winning is important to him. He's just bought the Lakers or bought a stake of the Lakers. Steve Pagliuca, who was one of the other bidders, runs the Boston Celtics. The Ricketts family run the Cubs. They all know that winning matters. Having a great stadium, having a compelling offer. These are, this language you don't like, you know, this whole sort of customer thing. But winning is part of that. Fenway Sports Group. They're all looking at Fenway Sports Group. Ah, that's how you do it. You bring US kind of discipline around finance. You bring our kind of know-how, our ability to sell stuff, to make a big noise. You've got the kind of global game there already. How can we kind of engage those, you know, that global fan base? How can we monetize them? How can we actually get some money out of people who don't live within an hour's drive of the stadium? You know, that's what they're buying. And the one of the reasons they love Chelsea is that someone has already pumped billions into them. They're piggybacking off Abramovich's 19-year reign. Yes, there are issues there. The stadium's a massive issue, massive. But someone has already made Chelsea famous.
Excellent. All right, well, that's a more positive spin. Thank you, Matt, just with obvious caveats, as you mentioned at the start. I look forward to reading more on The Athletic as this deal moves forward or not. But many, many thanks for joining us today.
You are welcome.
There you go. Chelsea taking on Wolves. 1 win in their last four, Chelsea, by the way, but Wolves similarly adrift. And that's Saturday at 3 o'clock. A little bit later on Saturday, you've got Man United visiting Brighton. Do you remember what happened last season when they went to the Amex?
Goal after the final whistle.
Madness.
Rare occurrence. Maybe there'll be one before the kickoff this time. Mix it up.
To be fair, it's that kind of week. You couldn't rule it out. Brentford taking on Saints in a key relegation clash. Norwich, West Ham. Yeah, you know, lots of things that could happen in all these fixtures. We'll talk about them on Monday when they've actually been and happened. Although, I know, Adrian, you want to have another word on Arsenal and their game with Leeds. Or two words, and those words are Eddie Nketiah.
Yeah, only a brief word. I just think it's worth mentioning. I just think he's been absolutely exceptional across these three matches. This is a guy that didn't start all season. Mikel Arteta did not trust him to have more than 5 minutes at the end of matches. And suddenly he was thrust into the starting 11 to start against Chelsea, Manchester United and West Ham. And he scored twice at Chelsea and I thought he was outstanding as the leader of the line in the games at United and West Ham. The way he held the ball up, his movement, the runs he made in behind as well, particularly against West Ham. You can see a player developing there. Now, it's probably too late for Arsenal. I think they'll move on from him and he'll move on from them. He probably does need a fresh start. But it's crazy, really, that it's come to this point in the season where everything matters so much to Arsenal. Every game's a cup final. The prospect of Champions League football is there within reach and they are relying on a guy that won't be there next season in all likelihood and someone that wasn't trusted until three games ago to start matches. It's amazing, but I will credit him for the way he's approached that task because he has looked better than Lacazette and this will be another interesting test for him against Leeds, and it would not surprise me if he was the hero here that scored a key goal.
Leeds, meantime, chasing not only 3 points in the relegation battle, but also the Premier League yellow card record, Duncan.
Yeah, we all thought they'd do it last weekend against City, but only got one, so it will happen, and it will happen.
So they need two to break it, or one to break it now?
No, one to break it now. They've equaled Sunderland's record.
They've equaled the record.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Excellent. And also happening this weekend, alongside those exciting Premier League fixtures, is also the final day of the WSL season. Has it set up nicely, Michael Cox?
Yeah, Chelsea in pole position. They're playing home to Manchester United. If they win, then they win the title for the third time in a row. The interesting thing is Manchester United are still playing for something. They want to try and jump up above Manchester City to get the third and final Champions League spot. Chelsea, I think, would be quite strong favourites. I suppose the interesting thing is that it would be their third title in a row, but it would be the first one they've really been able to celebrate properly. 2 years ago, the season didn't finish. It was done on points per game. There was no celebration. And a year ago, it was behind closed doors. So they had a bit of a muted celebration, I suppose. So if they do win it, I think it will be almost three celebrations in one.
Crikey, if they don't win it, it'll be Arsenal's title. They're only 1 point behind Chelsea. All the games will be kicking off at noon on Sunday. Arsenal, who took the title race to the final day with a victory Wednesday night against Spurs. Ooh, Arsenal are going to be at West Ham, Adrian.
Yeah, you'd think that they would do their part and get the 3 points against West Ham. They finished the season really strongly. They had a wobble, which allowed Chelsea to just nip in ahead of them, because Arsenal have led this title race for the bulk of the campaign. They just had a little bit of a sticky patch, and it looks like it's going to cost them. But I think Jonas Eidevall, in his first season as gaffer there, first season in English football, has done really, really well. My only fear is that, because Arsenal have got some really quality individuals, is that one or two might get picked off, because, yeah, as we've seen in the Champions League, there are some very, very impressive teams across the continent, and I think they might be eyeing up one or two of the Arsenal players.
All right, well, a delicate set of fixtures awaiting, and they all get underway noon on Sunday. Adrian, you're heading along to Arsenal's game with Leeds. Best of luck with that. Duncan, you've got Wickham Wanderers against MK Dons this evening. Our thoughts with you ahead of that huge match. Michael, where are you heading to this weekend?
I'm at Arsenal Leeds.
Are you? Okay.
So nice. I'm pleased Adrian has made me excited about that game.
Good. So there's at least two people going, just 4,552 more. And you'll,
I'm also going to Sheffield United v Fulham in the Championship on Saturday, 12:30, so that they get centre stage, the Championship. Obviously, the top two's done and dusted, but the playoff battle is really intriguing. I think there are four clubs battling for two spots on the final day, one of which is Sheffield United, but they've got Fulham, who are pretty good, as Luton will testify. So, it should be an interesting one at Bramall Lane.
Crikey. Well, if that's your bag, you can hear Adrian saying lots more things like that in the Totally Football League show, which will be up, if not yet, then very, very shortly. Adrian, off you go and record that. Many, many thanks for today. Thanks to you as well, Duncan and Michael Cox. Always a delight to have you with us. Producer Charlie, and above all, you, listener, have yourself a great weekend, and do join us again on Monday when we have a chat about all of that. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.